So again, as a reminder, this call is being recorded for later viewing by individuals who are owners, operators, employees, or are affiliated or working with congregate living settings. This call is off the record and not intended for members of the media. It is, however, being recorded right now. If you have concerns or objections, please disconnect. And the final thing is, in order to preserve everyone's bandwidth, if you would like, I welcome you to switch off your camera. Don't feel the need to, but if you would like to, please go ahead and do so, but not a hard request. There is a lot to be said for being able to see each other. So that's an option that I offer to everybody. With those housekeeping duties or details out of the way, I'd like to go through the agenda for today and what we hope to cover. I'm going to start by providing a brief situational update as to where things stand with respect to COVID-19 statewide. The next item on the agenda is to talk about best practices around infection control and infection prevention, as well as consultation availability. That's going to be handled by my colleague Rita Oshak from the Maine CDC, as well as Dr. Stephen Sears. After that, we're going to turn to a discussion and reminders around where things stand with requirements around conducting surveillance testing. That will be led by Director Bill Monteo of DLC. After that, we'll have a discussion and a reminder and an update on best practices for PPE, both in terms of how to request PPE and how to manage your own PPE inventory. That will be headed and led by our Director of Public Health Emergency Preparedness at Maine CDC, Mr. Bill Jenkins. After that, we'll talk and have a discussion around best practices regarding staffing, which has now become yet another issue as case counts have started to rise. That will be led by Desiree Chase from the Maine Department of Health and Human Services. And then finally, a recap of other regulatory expectations. They're led by Directors Monteo and Saucier, Director Saucier being from ODES. We're hoping to get through that in short order so we can leave as much time for questions as possible. So with that, as we get into the question and answer period, please feel free to put your questions in the chat box. Given that we've got 650 or so people on, that will certainly be the easiest way for us to pick up questions and look for themes. So with that as a wind up, I'm going to go ahead and dive in and talk about where things stand with respect to COVID-19 across the state. And the bottom line is that the COVID-19 situation is one that continues to raise concerns. As of this morning, there are just over 8,000 total cases of COVID-19 statewide. Sadly, just today alone, we reported 4 individuals who have passed away with COVID-19. And in recent days, as many of you have probably seen, we have reported an uptick in the number of individuals who have passed away. That in and of itself is concerning. Sadly, however, it's not something that was a surprise. That's because in concert with our increasing number of cases, we have also seen in the recent 2 or 3 weeks a corresponding increase in the number of individuals who are hospitalized. Right now in the state of Maine, 54 people are hospitalized, including 16 of whom are in the intensive care unit and 6 people who are on ventilators. Cumulatively, 538 people have been hospitalized, and just in the last 30 days alone, 64 have been hospitalized. All of those numbers are continuing to increase, be it the number of case count, the number of new cases, or the number of hospitalizations. One of the metrics that we use to get a sense of where things stand in the pandemic is the positivity rate. That is simply put, the number of tests over the last 7 days that have come back as PCR positive divided by the total number of tests that are done across the state of Maine. And there, the positivity rate has increased quite significantly just over the last 2 weeks. Right now, it stands at 2.2%. Just 2 weeks ago, it was around 0.65, 0.7%. So it has effectively tripled just in the last 2 weeks alone. Now, even though that's concerning, one potential silver lining that we have seen is that the volume of testing that we're doing across the state remains robust. The way we measure that is just the total number of PCR tests over the last 7 days, the average of those, divided by the number of people in the state. And we adjust that for every 100,000. And right now our testing volume stands at 600 PCR tests per every 100,000. That's almost double the nationwide testing volume. That's really important because it means we're able to detect cases somewhat more quickly and also then intervene upon them from a public health perspective. However, those cases can often multiply and spread and thus cause outbreaks. One of the things we've seen just in the past 2 weeks, unfortunately, is as cases go up, there are more cases in the community as a whole. And what's happened in Maine is that that high level of community transmission has started laying the groundwork or seeding the lawn and is now starting to generate more and more outbreaks. And unfortunately, one of the strong predictors of whether there will be outbreaks in congregate living settings is whether, or rather, what the level of community transmission is in the county in which that setting exists. Levels of community transmission, which we break down into 3 categories, low, medium, and high, have all been increasing over the last 2 to 3 weeks. And correspondingly, the number of outbreaks that we are seeing overall, as well as in congregate living settings, has started to go up steadily and surely as a result of that. Unfortunately, that will continue to increase. We do not see anything on the horizon that will cause a diminution in either the number of new cases, the positivity rate, the hospitalization rate, or sadly, the number of cases and outbreaks in your facilities. Now is the time to start taking action to shore up your defenses around an infection control perspective, from a PPE perspective, from a surveillance testing perspective, from a staff shortage perspective, indeed, all of the things that we're going to be talking about today. Now is the time to plan, prepare, and dust off the plans that you have already been working on since March. So with that, I'm going to turn things over to Rita Oshak and Dr. Steven Sears for reminders, updates, and discussion around best practices for infection control and infection prevention. Rita, I'll ask you to kick us off, if you could.
Sure. And I thought I'd spend some time today just going over, you know, the infection control basics that we all need to do and practice diligently in order to, you know, conquer the COVID pandemic. And so I'm going to just take us through a quick review of the chain of infection. This is a 6-link chain joined in a circle. You got to have a pathogen. The pathogen has to find a reservoir. It has to have a means of exiting the reservoir and being transmitted and entering another susceptible host. And then this is how infection keeps going around the circle. So just a quick review here, and want to just talk about each of these links in the chain. So we have an infectious agent, COVID-19. How do we stop it? So when somebody is ill, we need to isolate them or quarantine them. If we can keep folks, infected folks away from other folks, we can stop that spread right there and break that link in that chain. So it's very important to confirm with staff that if they're ill, they need to stay home. If they have symptoms or a temperature, they need to report that as part of the screening process so that the facility can act accordingly. If they do have a positive test, they do need to report that to the facility. There has been some public anxiety around reporting positive tests, and sometimes healthcare workers are encouraged not to report. So please affirm with your healthcare workers, it's very important so the facility can act accordingly. So COVID needs a reservoir. More than likely, COVID is going to enter your facility through a positive worker, vendor, someone who's out in the community and interacting with folks and then coming into the facility with the illness. So is your screening process active? When you're screening folks in your facility, is someone looking at those results and making sure someone didn't say, yeah, I got a temperature today. But if they just check the box on the paper and nobody notices that for several hours, that's an opportunity, that's a risk for the facility and transmission could be happening. So if temperature or symptoms are noted, is there a process within your facility to address that? So if somebody does report that they have a temper symptoms, what is the process to evaluate that temperature or symptoms and make sure it is or isn't COVID, and then whether or not the healthcare worker can come into work and work? So having that plan and letting staff know what that plan is and what that expectation is again key to stopping that infection. So the COVID needs a way to exit the reservoir that it's in, and that's typically through coughing, sneezing, singing, talking, or shouting. So how can we break the chain here? Source control, face covering all the time. Look for weaknesses in your facility as to where those face coverings are coming off. Is it a couple of staff working together alone in a space and they think they can unmask for a while? Is it in the break rooms when folks are eating?
Rita, you're muted.
Yep, I went ahead and muted everyone's line, but Rita, you should be able to unmute. Okay,
yeah, great. Got it. Yep. So look for those weak points in your source control in your facility. So the virus has to have a way to be transmitted. This is mostly a respiratory exhalation transmission route for COVID. Yes, contact is a possibility, but more than likely it's going to be through respiratory exhalations, being within 6 feet of someone who's infectious for 15 cumulative minutes in a 24-hour period. You have to have enough of a dose to acquire the virus. So physical distancing becomes important. Again, look for the weaknesses. Where are your folks gathering? We've heard tales of folks meeting together outside, may or may not be masked, but are within 6 feet of each other. And sometimes folks are working together. Look at the layouts in your facility. Can you get 6 feet between different functions within your facility? Weak points in source control and physical distancing have been identified as how an outbreak did get started. So portal of entry, how the virus enters the next person is through what we call the T-zone. It's the mucous membrane, so the eyes, the nose, and the mouth. So how do we break the chain here is what federal CDC is recommending, that when there's moderate to substantial transmission in your counties, universal PPE not only includes a mask at that point, but includes eye protection as well, because it is another portal of entry for the virus. So let's see. Keep in mind that with eye protection, your coworkers are more likely going to be bringing this into the facility. So eye protection is not just when you're working with residents, clients, or patients. It's also when you're in the presence of your coworkers. So again, then the last step is susceptible host. We have to take care of ourselves. A lot of people are working long hours. What can we do to make sure we're getting enough sleep, a little bit of exercise? What can we do to boost our immune system? And then vaccination would be another great way to help decrease our susceptibility, because should we receive a big enough dose of COVID, the more susceptible you are, of course, the more likely you are to become infected. So this is the basics of infection control. And even as numbers surge, this is our best defense against, COVID spreading. And we have to be really good at all of these tasks if we're going to, win the war of COVID.
Great. Thank you, Rita. That's very, very helpful. What I'd like to do is turn things over to Dr. Sears, and then we'll take questions related to infection control and infection prevention. Many of them are in their chat. I'll try to moderate those, but we'll try to take questions in chunks as we go along, just to make sure everyone's getting their key questions answered. So Dr. Sears.
Great. Thank you. And I always like to follow Rita because she's actually covered almost everything. So that doesn't leave all that much. I would just like to remind us that You know, Dr. Shaw has given us some sobering information. On the other hand, the good news is we can do something about it. And that's really, you know, what Rita has just described. And what it really means is you got to go and relook at all the things that you've looked at before, because we all get tired. We get tired and we sort of get into routines and we sometimes forget. And we have breakdowns in the things we know that are going to protect us. We know that distancing, masking, hand washing, and good ventilation are really what we need. The only thing I would add to this is what we really have seen is that people who work together like to party together. And you really have to try to remind staff that distancing and face coverings go on outside of the building. Because as Rita said, that's where we see the entry of COVID into facilities. It's through staff, and the staff are getting it in the community, and we know the community rates are going up. So I'm going to leave it at that and let you ask questions, because I know that we've got a lot to cover in this time today.
Yep. Thanks, Dr. Sears. I think one of the questions that I've seen come up is a little bit more discussion, Rita, around the nuances of eye protection. Is it better to do goggles and a face covering, goggles and a mask rather, versus a face shield and a mask, so on and so forth. So if you could expound upon eye protection and what the latest data are there, that would be great, Rita.
So eye protection does not include eyeglasses, because the goal of eye protection is to stop a splash or spray to your face. So if I'm just wearing my eye protection, that splash or spray can go down from the top. It can go around from the sides. So whether your goggles tend to be very close fitting to your face, some safety glasses have like a lid on top and sides that wrap around that you can wear over your eyeglasses in a lot of cases. So you're basically looking for how much protection can you get. A face shield where it's closed up on the top and wraps around the side of your face, comes down below your chin, is good. You want to stop that spray from reaching your mucous membranes of your eyes. So there's a variety of choices. There is no which one is better than another. It's maybe what's more practical for your setting and what your needs are.
Great. Thanks, Rita. Let me open it up. If anyone wants to unmute and ask a question, but if not, please feel free to keep throwing them in the chat, and I'll look for a couple of themes. I know that there are other questions around antigen testing, surveillance testing, such things. We will definitely get those or pick those up. But right now I wanted to just tackle questions around infection control and prevention. Let's see here. Rita, this is a question that comes up. The difference, or you know, is there any need to use surgical masks versus cloth face coverings? And I think in a healthcare facility, our recommendation is that you use something designed not just to be a barrier, but also, as Rita mentioned, that could potentially absorb spray. So Rita, unless I'm getting it wrong, in a healthcare setting, a proper surgical mask, or if indicated, a respirator is the way to go.
Yeah, in healthcare, it's recommended that the PPE be reserved for healthcare workers, and PPE is a surgical mask or a respirator. The cloth face coverings everywhere else. The difference between a cloth face covering and a surgical mask is the fluid resistance is built into the surgical mask. It's not usually there in a cloth face covering. So if PPE were short, I mean, one of the substitutes would be the cloth face covering with a face shield, because the face shield would give you the fluid protection over the cloth face covering. But use the PPE in healthcare when you have it.
And then the last question that I wanted to address that came in, which is, at what level of community transmission does there need to be before eye protection is indicated? Eye protection is indicated full stop at all levels of community transmission right now. It doesn't really turn on what the level is. And so eye protection, as Rita had discussed, is something that every facility should be implementing right now. Go ahead. Yep.
So I have heard, and I wanted to find out what your thought was on best practices regarding how long you should be using surgical masks or regular masks, I would imagine, but if our policy is surgical masks, I've heard that there's like a 4-hour window where we should be changing them regularly. And I wanted to find out your thoughts on, because obviously healthcare workers work sometimes longer shifts than regular every day. So I wanted to get your thoughts on that.
Rita, that's a great question that is right up your alley.
So with PPE supplies the way they are now, we're hoping that facilities are having to not reuse or extended use of PPE, because the idea, there is risk associated with that. Now with increasing cases, it's possible that facilities may need to go back to that. So, the thing they pretty much look at is, I know with respirators, they're saying really it's one shift or no more than 5 doffings. And I think the same would apply to surgical masks. Every time you take it off and you put it back on, there's risk of also just kind of contaminating yourself with virus that may be on the outside. So if any mask gets hard to breathe through, that's a signal that it may need to, it's time that the filtration is plugging up and it needs to be changed. But there are, under NIOSH, there are some reuse and extended use, as well as on federal CDC sites that help guide you with this. But keep in mind that none of these practices are routine practices. They should only be used when there is a severe shortage of PPE.
Great. So we will absolutely have time to revisit and have more discussion on infection control and infection prevention. But in order to keep us moving, I'm going to turn things over to Director Bill Monteo for the latest with respect to surveillance testing. Director?
Thank you, Dr. Shaw. So there have been a couple of memos that have gone out to facility administrators. They are also posted on both the DLC website and on the Office of Aging and Disability Services website that deal with surveillance testing. So in Maine, and we have reviewed and have CMS's approval, we in Maine are following the same principles, but a different metric, in that we are not using the federal county positivity standard. We are using the number of new cases per 10,000 population, which the Maine CDC does post on its website as well. So, and we have issued guidance document on October 9th that went out to the assisted living congregate living facilities that identified facility types. And essentially, all nursing homes and ICF IID facilities must do staff surveillance testing. Whoever just Jardins is, you need to mute. Thank you.
And Bill, I muted everybody, and so there you go. Thanks.
Yeah, thank you. Have to do surveillance testing at least monthly, or more frequently, consistent with the CDC's determination of where the county is that the facility is located. And by that, our guidance document identifies low risk counties as new cases of 8 per 10,000 population or less, moderate counties being new cases of between 8 and less than 16 cases per 10,000 population, and high risk counties as being any county in which the number of new cases is 16 or greater per 10,000 population. And again, those numbers are posted on the Maine CDC's website. So that would essentially follow the same standard that CMS issues in their QSO 2039 memorandum that identifies low, moderate, and high risk. So any facility in a county that's identified as a low or moderate risk is currently testing monthly all staff. Any facility in a high risk county is doing it every 2 weeks. And then outbreak testing, obviously you're going to work with the CDC once you've identified a positive to determine universal testing and outbreak testing. And within the assisted housing, we've broken it down further into essentially two groups. Group A being groups, the facilities that require surveillance testing of staff, and those are
facilities that are designated as Alzheimer's or dementia care facilities, the PNMI residential care facilities that follow Appendix C for main care Appendix C. And then Group B would be the facilities that are not required to do surveillance testing. And those are our adult PNMI residential care facilities that are not included in Group A, adult family care homes, and adult group homes with ID or small populations. And that is all spelled out in the memorandum that went out on October 9th.
Great. Many thanks, Bill. There's a couple of questions that had come in previously that I think are particularly relevant right now. I think the first category of them is around visitation. Could you just provide a quick synopsis of where things stand with respect to visitation?
So in federally certified facilities, nursing homes and ICF IAD facilities, visitation is addressed in that CMS memorandum, which essentially states you can only restrict visitation by certain parameters, and one being you're in an outbreak situation. You have to follow the federal core principles for screening staff and visitors, allowance, even if you're in an outbreak situation, of compassionate care visitation. And there are certain requirements for the visitors. Your facilities are encouraged. The nursing homes have point of care testing devices, and they're encouraged to test visitors, but they're not required to test visitors, nor are they allowed nor can they require visitors to take a test to come in and conduct visitation. In our assisted housing, visitation is guided by the guidance document that went out with the October 9th memorandum that breaks things down based on the county's caseload and allows for visitation in low and moderate. But in counties where there's high risk or outbreak situation, then it really restricts visitation to compassionate care situations. And that's further defined in the guidance.
Great. Thanks, Bill. The other category of questions is what you referenced just a second ago, which is the use of the antigen testing machines, either those by Becton Dickinson or Quidel, that many of the folks on this call will have received, not all, but many, depending on the type of your facility, and whether those can be used for the routine surveillance testing. Bill, I'll turn that back over to you, but I'm happy to pick it up if you want.
Certainly. From the CMS perspective, the federal government has allowed the utilization of those devices for surveillance testing. So nursing homes can use a private lab to conduct surveillance testing. They can also use their point of care testing devices for surveillance testing.
Chime in for a sec?
Yep.
Because I think it's important to recognize that if you start having an outbreak, we're going to quickly ask you to switch over to use PCR if you have been using the antigen tests, because that way we get a good handle on an outbreak and can really follow through. And until the outbreak is completed, we'll continue to use PCR for those situations. The only other thing I'd mention is that our experience now with people doing surveillance testing is it's been very effective. We found cases in staff very early on before it's had a chance to spread in other situations that it has spread, but it's been very effective.
Agreed. Yeah, we have... the word prevent is a strong word, but we have detected cases among employees in numerous settings and have been able to intervene quickly. And we believe and hope that had prevented outbreaks. Very difficult standard to to say that something did not happen, but it has certainly proven itself to be effective. Bill, there are a couple of other questions that have come in. You noted the way in which the state of Maine has opted to provide guidance, focusing on incidence as opposed to positivity rate. Anything further with respect to, as we get into the holidays, any tips that you might have for helping facilities navigate that?
We are still awaiting federal guidance from CMS for the federally certified facilities. But in general, there's the ongoing question about people going home for the holidays and what, the difficult part is, especially in a assisted living facility, if a resident wants to leave and go home, we would look to for a day visit or for a holiday visit. We would really look to the facility to educate the family and the resident about the risks that poses. If they're adamant that they're going to do it, then the resident would have to be treated as a COVID status unknown and quarantined and isolated upon return. It does create a lot of hardship for both the facility and for the family and for the residents. So I think, until we have the further definitive guidance from CMS, what we would say is we want to strongly discourage those types of visits. But anytime, and it is addressed in the guidance that we've put out with ODES about really anytime somebody leaves outside of the facility activities, non-escorted by facility staff, they're treated as a COVID unknown and isolated and quarantined.
Great. Thanks, Bill. Just to keep us moving again, we'll have time to address all questions on all topics. I'm going to turn things over to Bill Jenkins, the head of public health emergency preparedness within Maine CDC, to talk about where we stand with respect to PPE best practices in terms of checking your inventory and then how to make requests. So Bill, can I turn that over to you?
Sure thing, Director. Good afternoon, everybody. Thank you for taking the time out of your afternoon. So the Maine CDC's Public Health Emergency Preparedness Program continues to manage our state's PPE cache via a central distribution facility. To date, we've sent out over 3,400 individual PPE orders, totaling just under 3 million actual items. Much of that has been sent to congregate care facilities since we started our distribution process mid to late February. So what we wanted to let you folks know is that the facilities that are experiencing PPE shortages, you can still contact your county emergency management agency. Let them know, which facility you're calling and representing, and ask them to submit a PPE request into our online tracking system. And for those who have been doing this right along, it's probably nothing new, but for those who may be going through this process for the first time, just want you to be aware that there's a number of qualifying questions that will be asked of the county EMA before your request is actually submitted. So again, the questions are just asking if your facility has a respiratory protection program in place, whether or not you've been fit tested at this agency or the facility within the 12 months prior, and have you exhausted resources on hand? So what we're getting with that is, we can't be the end all be all. So we're asking to do a little bit of work on your end to say, if we can fill some of these requests locally, great. If not, the county EMA will go ahead and submit that in that resource request. Once they hit submit, it goes directly to my team and I at the distribution warehouse. We then process, pick, and ship out your orders. The actual submission process and the time to pick, process, and ship is a pretty quick process. So just wanted to let folks know that we do ship out orders from our warehouse on a daily basis. We also want folks to know that the transporting logistics chain that we have is a mix of UPS and also personal drop-offs by the Maine DOT and or the National Guard. So don't be surprised if you see a government, a van show up at your facility. They are there to help. They are there to drop off PPE supplies. I guess a couple of considerations, kind of looking at where we are worldwide with PPE. Medical grade N95s and the sizes small and extra small are still unicorns out there on the commercial market. We literally get probably 120 N95s, medical grade, a month. So that's not really going to cut it. So just note that, we may not not have everything in the stockpile that you are regard to the size. We always try to do the best that we can do. So for instance, if you're asking for a size medium gown, by chance, if we're out of a medium, we'll go ahead and send you some larges. So we always try to match it up as best as we can. And just to let folks know kind of what is available in the state cache, we do have N95s. We do have some medical grade N95s, not large quantities, mostly in universal sizes, but those aren't the kind of gold standard 3M model 1860. We have a bunch of 3M 9105s, all surgical grade, FDA, NIOSH compliant. It just may not look like the respirator that you're used to seeing. We also have surgical masks available, face shields, gloves, and gowns. The one thing that the federal government neglected to kind of start shipping to us was eye protection, so goggles. Those are the one item that I think was kind of overlooked at the federal process. So, but we're hoping a lot of folks do have those in their inventories currently. Just wanted to let folks know, if you answer negative to any of those questions, meaning you do not currently have a respiratory protection plan or have been fit tested, we're legally not allowed to send you a medical grade N95. Now, it's not the main CDC or anyone that's going to be following up from our perspective, but you know, just be aware that the Department of Labor is out there and does routinely check up on those types of things. So just beware, so to speak. The last thing is really kind of, you know, expectations around when you'll get your order. My team and I are usually working, you know, 6-7 days a week. Long hours, but you know, as soon as you get it into the county EMA director, that gets submitted usually by mid-morning, and we're picking and pulling and shipping orders by the afternoon. If possible, we just ask that I wouldn't be looking for your PPE order for around 24 hours, maybe 36 hours. Again, the time frame isn't necessarily from the warehouse, but once we do the handoff to UPS, for instance, you know, it takes a day or two for them to get out to all the locations in Maine. So I would advise folks, you know, the time to request PPE is not during an outbreak. So if you call up and say, hey, we have an outbreak, we need PPE here in 4 hours, that's going to be a real tough challenge. So what we're asking folks is to kind of front load the game in the system, right? You know, if you're getting to a point where you feel you're critically low in a certain item, go ahead and submit that request now. We don't want you folks to have to scramble and try to worry about where are we going to get PPE in the midst of, you know, an outbreak in your facilities, which is, you know, horrible. It's stressful and hard on everybody there. So that is kind of our request process. Still pretty much the same thing that we've been doing since mid-March. And happy to answer any questions.
Awesome. That's perfect, Bill. Thank you. So I want to just underscore and echo what Bill said. Now is the time to start assessing your PPE inventory and projecting whether you have enough on hand. And if you don't, now is the time, before you experience an outbreak or start getting into that upward trend, to assess your overall inventory and be in touch with your county EMA. I can't emphasize that enough. Bill, one of the questions that's come up in the chat that's either publicly or been directed to me is around fit testing. As many folks know, we undertook dozens upon dozens of fit testing missions in partnership with the National Guard over the summer. But many of those have scaled back now, and we've sort of used a train-the-trainer model. For facilities that are looking to beef up the number of individuals who have been fit tested, as well as set up a respiratory protection program, what advice would you have right now?
The issue is resource. We have plenty of the solutions to do the fit testing. We have plenty of the hoods. The one scarcity that we're finding are the little plastic nebulizers that you use to administer the smoke test. So that is our limiting thing. So we have a number of kits around the state. We have 5 or 6 that we keep on reserve. Our National Guard fit testing team has 3 or 4 of those. And we also have one that we can loan out to facilities through the state emergency management office. But I would say, and I also see another thing here asking about fit test train the trainer. You're right. We have moved to a model of actually not doing the actual fit test training, but doing a train the trainer model. We felt that would give us a little bit more bang for the buck. And it would kind of help decentralize some of that testing and requirements on the state resources. But yeah, I would say if you are looking to have somebody come in, most notably the National Guard, we still are kind of reconstituting the train the trainers, not the actual fit testing. And the issue really comes into, you know, we've spent a good amount of the last 6 or 7 months literally training 4,000 or 5,000 healthcare workers across the state with fit testing. And I believe we've been able to train just slightly less than 500 train the trainers. So there are more of these resources out there. They're out there in your communities. And I would say first off would be your county EMA, because I know a lot of those folks are doing the fit testing for some of the facilities. There are times where a county EMA may say, nah, we're not gonna do that. And if so, you know, please make sure that that request gets to the main CDC, and we'll see what we can do on your behalf.
Great. And then Bill, I think this is an equally question for you as well as probably Rita, because this one comes up a lot still, which is the relative effectiveness of KN95s versus the regular N95s. Bill, what's your take? And if we want to get Rita in on the discussion, we can.
Yep. Well, when we first kind of started this back in January, we're told that, you know, medical grade N95s weren't available. But long story short, you know, we meaning the entire nation, not just Maine, did order a bunch of KN95s. These are supposedly the Korean equivalents of a NIOSH FDA N95, like 3M 1860 models. When we got our first batches in from overseas, we actually did a pretty extensive testing, and none of those were able to pass the fit test requirements. So at that point, you know, then these were being hailed as this is the equivalent of an N95. Our own internal testing with many folks at the Maine CDC, and Rita was involved in that, we couldn't get a proper fit test on any of those. So we basically said, we're not going to use those. We are not going to send those out to the medical community as an N95. I think what we decided as an agency is that those would be more than effective as a face covering or a procedure mask, but not to be used as an N95. And I guess, Rita, I guess that's the extent of where I would feel comfortable discussing that. And if you have anything further to add with regards to the science, be more than happy to hear your input.
No, but I think that's where it's at. There were some hospitals that reported they did get good fit testing compliance with some KN95s. So it may depend on the vendor, but we didn't always know who the vendor was with those. So I think if you have some, try fit testing, folks. If you have a high failure rate, they're a surgical mask at that point.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. Well, again, in order to just keep us moving, I'm gonna shift gears a bit to talk about staffing. That has started to emerge as a consideration and concern as we've been working with facilities on more and more outbreaks across facilities across Maine. So I'm gonna ask Desiree Chase, who works with us at the Maine Department of Health and Human Services and specializes in healthcare staffing, to talk about where things stand and best practices from her end.
Thanks, Dr. Shaw. So there was a couple things that I wanted to highlight with folks that you could be doing prior to an outbreak that will hopefully make that situation a bit easier should you encounter it. First off, we've dealt with a lot of facilities that do not use outside agencies for staffing on a regular basis. That's great. When you encounter an outbreak, though, it may become necessary. Starting those contracts can be timely and time consuming. So that would be something that I would work on now, even if you don't have an outbreak, to make sure you have something in place and a pool of possible candidates to pull from. I'd also start talking with your local hospital and any other community agencies that you have partnerships with that you could pull staff, parent organizations, anything where you can quickly pull a body or two to cover for a positive test patient that's out. Let's see, what else can we talk about here? The next thing that we have encountered is how to incentivize your current staff to pick up extra shifts. There are several different ways you can do that. So as a facility, looking at what model might work best for you, we have seen just an extra $5 an hour to try to get people to pick up a shift, or there has been blocks of time. So if you have 8-hour shifts that your staff works, you could break that down where they'll be incentivized to pick up half of a shift or more incentivized to pick up a full shift. One of the more interesting models we saw was if somebody picked up 7 shifts over the course of a month, they would receive a bonus. So that could really help in a long-term game. There are no real fast ways to get staff if this stuff isn't in place and everybody is encountering the same problems that you are. So laying some of this groundwork first could really speed up how you can have some help at your agency. So I think that's really what I wanted to highlight, Dr. Shaw.
Great, thanks, Desiree. There's one other note that I'll make with respect to staffing. One of the things that we know has put a significant burden on facilities that are experiencing outbreaks or even a number of cases is that those who are deemed to be close contacts, those employees who are deemed to be close contacts must in a typical setting be in quarantine for 14 days. But with the arrival and advent of reliable point of care testing, such as the antigen machines from Becton Dickinson and Quidel, there is the opportunity for asymptomatic, and I want to stress, bold, and underline the word asymptomatic. Asymptomatic close contacts can conceivably come to work and be immediately tested before they set foot in the building and expose anybody. They can be tested. And if they test negative for that day and are asymptomatic during that time period, they can work provided they are in full PPE. I want to state that again. Individuals who have been exposed and found to be close contacts of a confirmed case, if they are employees, they can be tested with the point of care antigen machines that many of your facilities have. And if they test negative and are asymptomatic on the day of their shift, they can work that shift provided that they are in full PPE. This is an opportunity that exists for critical infrastructure workers. It's not something that exists for the general population, but given the nature of the work that each and every one of you do, the folks on your team would be considered critical infrastructure workers. So with that, we will take questions around anything related to staffing.
Dr. Shaw. One thing I do want to point out, we know that many of the assisted housing facilities do not have infection control specialists or consultants. And I do want to note that Director Saussure put in the chat that the department does have consultation services available for assisted housing providers and to reach out to Gretchen Zeta Higgins to take advantage of those services so that you can have somebody come out to your facility and review and assist you with the development of an infection control program.
Thank you. Let's take a look here. Okay, so questions around what I just mentioned, which is on staffing. What if they are awaiting a test result? If they are awaiting a test result, then it doesn't work. They have to have a negative test result. It can be from an antigen test, but it has to be a result that was just immediately taken. It cannot be a PCR test. It must be something that you have an immediate result upon, most ideally an antigen test, because you have a result within 10 or 15 minutes. Question that's come up go ahead.
I'm sorry, Dr. Shaw. My name is Tiffany. I'm a nurse at a small assisted living facility. And I have a question more specific to quarantining as a staff member when you've been in close contact, if you don't have a negative result, or if somebody's tested negative and they have symptoms, should they not be allowed to work?
Okay.
Or if they've been in close contact with somebody that's positive,
Okay, let me make sure I so the middle one, Tiffany, is very clear. If they've been exposed and they have any symptom that could be COVID, they cannot come to work. Does not matter what their test result shows. Full stop, period. Your first question was, I think, what do we do when we're waiting for the result? There, they can't come into work. They've got to have a negative. And then their third one is that they were a close contact. You don't have a test result, but they don't have any symptoms. Can't come to work. You've got to be asymptomatic and have a negative rapid result from their last 10 minutes or so. It can't be something that was taken yesterday or the day before. It's got to be from a rapid test. And if they test negative and they are asymptomatic, they can come to the, they can work their shift, but they've got to be in PPE, full PPE, which means an N95 respirator, eye protection, gloves, and a gown.
Okay, thank you.
This is different from earlier in the epidemic, mainly because we now have the availability of rapid tests. Let's see here. And then question here about rural communities and the rapid tests. Again, the distribution of these rapid tests, the Becton Dickinson and Quidel machines, that was handled by the federal government, these point of care machines. That's something that they made the decisions and allocations on, not us, but we're checking to see whether additional machines may be forthcoming. Just to keep us moving, we can again come back to this, but I would like to at least wrap up the presentation side of things by talking more generally about other regulatory changes and expectations. So I'd like to turn that back over to Director Monteo as well as Director Paul Saucier.
Thank you, Dr. Shaw. Bill, I can start just by reinforcing some things you referenced earlier today. I would say the most relevant guidance right now is the most recent guidance that we and DLC have put out. And so just to describe that a little bit more, at late October, October 21st, we put out guidance about essentially what level of engagement with the community is safe. And that really depends on the level of community transmission. So it's a guidance, and then there's a chart attached to it that indicates different levels of community activity at different transmission levels. So in terms of expectations, we certainly hope that you've consumed that guidance, and on the 3rd of November, from many, many questions that we received on the guidance, we issued an FAQ, which really the shortcut is to go to that because it has links back to the guidance. And it references many of the questions that were asked today about visitation, going home for the holidays, and so on. I think a positive thing about the way that Maine has structured this guidance around the level of transmission is that it doesn't need to change frequently, but you need to be watching what the transmission level in your county is. And so we have five counties right now, for instance, that are in the high transmission rate status, which means that, you know, visitation is only for compassionate care, for example. Volunteers are not allowed at that level, et cetera. So there are aspects of what you can and should do that change with the level of community transmission, and really recommend that if you have not, you go to the ODES website, which I posted earlier in the chat today, and get the FAQs. I think that also we get a lot of questions about, you know, well, what if a resident wants to do X? And so we have a couple of different assessment guides that are designed to be used with residents. When you get a question like that, it's an opportunity to educate the residents about what is safe and what is not, and what the consequences will be if they choose to proceed with something that is not safe. It's a really good way to involve everybody in these decisions and increase awareness all around. So one of those assessment tools is linked in the FAQs, so you can find it there. But do take the opportunity to work with residents. We know that you get a lot of resistance and that these are not easy situations to deal with. Many of the providers who've used the assessment tools have told us that it's a very effective way to have a conversation with folks. So I think that's what I would highlight. And you know, Bill, I don't know if you want to add more.
Oh, you touched on it very, very well, Paul. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Director Saussure. I'm going to look through some of the questions that have just come in and try to answer one or two and then also tap my colleagues. Okay, let me just tackle one or two that are in connection with what I mentioned around testing of exposed asymptomatic close contacts. One of them is, would we be able to use the BinaxNOW COVID-19 antigen cards to clear staff who have been exposed but are asymptomatic if performed at the start of each shift? The answer there is, in concept, yes. However, those cards are, even though we intend to receive or hope to receive a fair number of them, they're still coming in somewhat of a trickle. So we would recommend right now you utilize the antigen testing machines that your facility may already have. Related question that came in around infection control or prevention, I think this is more for Dr. Sears. How many days after you have detected a positive employee, how many days after detecting that positive employee do you recommend surveillance testing of all the residents and employees at the facility?
So if I understand the question, in a long-term care facility, you identify a staff member who's positive. We recommend universal testing at that point in time. And what we have found is that if that person is positive, they may well have spread it in the facility and it's being transmitted laterally and you haven't seen it. So we do that. We then gather that information and then make the decision on the next testing, which may be up between 5 and 7 days.
Great. Thanks, Dr. Sears. And then going back to the earlier discussion around staff testing who are exposed and asymptomatic. If someone tests negative and is asymptomatic, as I mentioned, they can, because they are critical infrastructure workers, come in to work their shift. They have to be in full PPE. So the question is, how long does that procedure need to go on for? And that needs to go on for 14 full days. That is the normal period of their quarantine. So at every single shift that they appear for, 14 days after their date of exposure, they need to be asked at the start of the shift, do they have any symptoms at all? If yes, no go. If they don't have any symptoms, they can be tested. And if negative, they can work, but that process has to continue for 14 days. Let me see if we can pick up some other questions. Actually, there was someone who raised their hand and I saw it pop up on my screen. If you raise your hand and you'd like to chime in, please do so. It was Lena, I believe.
Yes. Hi, sorry. Sorry if I'm shouting. I'm from a Res Care facility in Auburn. My question, first of all, can you hear me?
Oh, we can. We can,
Lena.
Go ahead.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, we can. Go ahead.
Oh, okay. Sorry. So this might be bringing us back a little bit farther, maybe back to March and April, but just for some, a little bit of guidance, if we have, as an assisted living facility, we don't have 24-hour nursing. If we get an outbreak of active COVID cases within our facility, and they become very clinically complex, are we to try to manage them here, or are we to send them to the local hospitals? Our concern, I think, is obviously making sure, first of all, patient safety is number one, but we don't, you know, want to inundate the emergency room or the ICU. So could you just kind of give a little bit of guidance on that? I know, again, it's bringing us back to March and April, but I think we've kind of gone so far where we've not had any outbreak cases within our facility. So we want to make sure that if it does happen and they become clinically complex and unmanageable, where we go from there.
Well, Lena, your question's a good one, because in many ways it is March, April, and May in Maine again, at least with respect to COVID-19. So if you have an individual in your care who's starting to develop symptoms, I think the best thing to do is defer to what your medical director or your medical protocols are. If your medical director or your in-house healthcare providers feel like that person is too acute for your facility, absolutely make plans to transfer them to a higher acuity facility. There's not a one-size-fits-all approach, but given the possibility of transmission within the facility, that's the kind of thing where you want to act on much more quickly than kind of waiting and seeing how it evolves. There's so much to say there, but I think that's a situation where you have a symptomatic person, you want to be acting very quickly in consultation with your medical providers.
Okay, thank you. I do have one more question. I apologize. The vaccines that Pfizer has rolled out, are we getting any guidance on that? Has the state received any guidance on that or anything regarding that vaccine?
We have been working on vaccine planning since March and April. I'm not going to go into it because that's another 5 or 6 hour discussion unto itself. But there's a lot of moving pieces with respect to vaccines, both the Pfizer vaccine, the Moderna one, as well as those that are being produced by Astra, Oxford, and others. Won't go into it now because there's a lot there, but there's a lot of planning underway to be ready for those.
Okay, great. Thank you.
I have one question as well, and it's about the testing. So there's been a lot of discrepancy about the mid-nasal versus the full nasal pharyngeal. I've spoken to the CDC Times who said that they feel that the mid-nasal is appropriate for universal testing and also appropriate for somebody that's symptomatic. I just, want to make sure that that is still the case and we're okay with that.
Yep, I don't think there's been any discrepancy. What you've been told is correct. Mid-terminate okay. Swabbing is acceptable.
Okay.
That's and a change from very early in the pandemic when nasal pharyngeal processes were recommended, but subsequent studies found that there was sufficient viral activity in the mid-terminate, so that is an acceptable manner of swabbing.
Do we feel like we're missing a big percentage by doing the mid-nasal versus the narrow pharyngeal or whatever?
No.
Okay. I just want to make sure of that because for our facilities, and I think for the universal testing, obviously that's much friendlier. So we'd like to stick with that, but I wanted to be sure that you're comfortable with that. Perfect. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Also, actually, one more question. So you mentioned about the visitation, and I thought it was interesting. So basically, we have to keep the doors open unless we're in high. If we feel that we have a peaking situation, for example, in the Androscoggin area, we definitely have a lot of links to the current outbreak. We can't make that decision to close up visits and do window visits and Zoom visits, monitor the situation in the community?
So if you're a federally certified facility, a nursing home or an ICF IAD, you have to follow the criteria and the guidance outlined in the CMS memorandum.
Which is to keep the doors open. So, but an assisted living facility could monitor the situation.
In assisted living facility, we would ask that you follow the guidance that Paul referenced that we've sent out. We want to make sure that we are restricting visitation based on appropriate clinical needs, because there are also psychosocial needs to these residents that we need to be careful and cognizant of.
Absolutely.
So, changing maybe the visitation to allow for some different visitation based on your county risk. And compassionate care visitation.
Very good.
Visitation in an adequate way. If we see a peak, we could do that.
I would say you need to follow that guidance. And if you need additional, you can reach out to Jen Gary on the assisted living here at licensing, and she'll help you with that.
Okay, thank you.
Can I ask a question?
Sure, go ahead.
This is probably directed towards Bill. Bill, is there any
discussion about allowing us to change and use emergency CNA training. I know there's some guidance at, I believe, the federal level for an 8-hour temporary CNA. Is there any discussions about changing the CNA requirements at the state level for staffing purposes during this pandemic?
So the CMS has issued waivers. The CNA, if you're talking about new CNA certifications, that's regulated by the Board of Nursing. They established the criteria. But there is guidance that we issued back in April that's listed on our website that addresses a staffing progression and does address how you can bring in people who are not currently certified CNAs when you're in a staffing crisis to help with meeting staffing needs and how to do that process.
Can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead.
Yes, this is Bonnie Brooks, and I'm a director at OHI up in the Down East area. And this is, I don't know whether it's an observation or a question for you, Dr. Shah, and for Paul. I'm really worried about providers of IDD services who are not in larger agencies like the agency I work for, or even in licensed places. And this information being given out today is very complicated, very complex. The information given out by OHD, same thing, and it's ever changing as it needs to be. And I'm very concerned about people with disabilities who are out there living in much smaller facilities. And I'm wondering, how can we, as concerned citizens, reach out to those people? I mean, this is a whole 101 that needs to be given to these moms and pops. And I wonder, how can we do this together?
Mm-hmm. I think you're exactly right. Go ahead, Paul.
Well, I just thank you for the question, Bonnie. We're struggling with that very question, and we're open to ideas. I think it is, you know, to the extent that large agencies like yours are willing to do some mentoring of the smaller agencies around you. We know that those small one-off kind of homes are not likely to be part of a provider association. That's another route that we use to reach people. And they're not all licensed, because we have pushed stuff out to all licensed locations. And that's one way to at least get the information out there. But we're continuing to think about ways to reach them, and we're open to any thoughts people have about that.
Okay, thank you.
Given the number of questions, it is clear that this will not be the last such webinar or forum of this nature. And so again, in order to respect everyone's very packed schedules these days, I'm gonna call for one last question, or alternately any closing comments from my colleagues, but please know we will work to set up repeats of these forums so that you can get your questions answered. We may not always have answers, or the answers we may have may not be favorable or helpful for you, but we can at least make sure we have a forum so that you can get your questions at least raised, and we can try to see what we can do to find answers for them. So with that as the wind up, for any of my colleagues, any closing comments in light of anything you've seen in the chat or that you've heard that you want to clarify or answer?
One very practical question that's come up a few times, Dr. Shah, is where will the recording be? I mean, I don't know if you're planning on putting it on CDC. If not, we're happy to put it on the OHD site or both.
I think it's going to probably be a both and. And so we'll find a home for it on the CDC website. Given that we're going to probably be doing these, we probably just need to have a webinar section, and we'll ask our colleagues at OHDS and DLC to do the same. So we will do something of that nature pretty soon. And it looks like someone's already singing us out. So with that, I'm gonna thank everyone for their time this afternoon. We appreciate it. We recognize we were not able to get to even a fraction of the questions. So we'll hopefully have another session where it's a lot less of us talking and a lot more of you asking questions, and we'll try to get answers in the interim. So please stay tuned for a notification around that, as well as a notification for when this recording will be on the website. With that, thank you all for your time this afternoon. We very much appreciate it, And we'll look to talk again soon.